everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast with myself, Jasmine Harrison, and I'm joined by Joe Kirk, and we were joined by Phil Brynan, but he's not here.
Hello.
Yeah. So this week's session was a Roper roundup, a practical workshop to discuss ropers, all weird and wonderful things around them. So how did you find it, Joe?
I thought it was a really good session. I think it flowed really well, and it was unstructured in the sense that there was no real like direction. But I think that's because ropers are such like the fundamental pieces, and there's so many areas within an organization's data protections, data controllers' obligations that are within a roper. So it's quite tricky, isn't it, to go through, you know, and pick and have some sort of flow to it. But I do think, though, that the session was very useful. We had some really good conversations, yeah. And the chat was unbelievably busy, probably the busiest I've seen it in a long time. But I think my favourite part, I think, was around when I put forward the notion of, if you're a data protection officer, you come into an organisation, you get a roper, and it's way off in terms of the lawful basis that are selected. How do you then change the lawful basis, knowing that the ICO is, I don't say it's frowned upon, would you say? I mean, it's not considered a good thing to do. It's really tricky, isn't it, to change a lawful basis. And I think that conversation was probably my favorite, where I think you have to take a bit more of a pragmatic approach in those sort of instances, because obviously if it's in an inappropriate lawful basis, then it's not lawful processing. So you're kind of stuck, aren't you? And I think that was a really good section of the podcast for me. What about you?
Yeah, no, I enjoyed it as well. I think, you know, you say that it was unstructured, but to be honest, often those conversations work the best anyway on the podcast, and it means that we could cover more ground, because, you know, aside from us having what we wanted to talk about, there was so much to back that up in the chat. Even just talking about, you know, delving into publicly available ropers, I enjoyed that part of the conversation.
Yeah,
it's something that I'd not really thought about until today, and it's a good point. Like, why don't we publicize our ropers? What for what reasons? Either way, and someone shared in the chat a couple of published ropers from University of Liverpool and Uni of Manchester. And it was really interesting to see their approaches. And I'm hoping that they are just publicly available ones, and there's more detail on their internal ones, because, you know, people were then saying in the chat, oh, I might do the same. I might follow suit, which was a bit worrying. But aside from that, it was it's just nice to get a fresh perspective, really, isn't it?
It is. Yeah, it's you're right. It's not something that you rarely come across with public ropers, and you're quite right as to, you know, we did delve into it a little bit, didn't we, in the podcast, talking about, you know, why isn't it a case of that ropers aren't publicly made available, simply because most of the information that you find within a roper can be found within your privacy policy. So it's something to dwell over, and it's probably not a bad thing to put it on there, because, you know, it can easily demonstrate accountability as you, an organization, that you have towards, you know, specific processes and legal obligations that you have under the law. So yeah, I'm surprised, but, you know, maybe it's something that we'll start seeing moving forward.
Yeah, true. Now, before we let you go into the main part of the session, this probably was covered last week. I don't know if, you know, those who are listening were here last week or not, but it goes without saying again that we are IAPP approved, which means that you can gain credits for listening to our podcast now, which, you know, we're really excited about. So big things are coming, and I think the podcast is going in a really positive trajectory. And, you know, there will be things to come your way to as a thank you to give back. So stay tuned for those things in the near future. But in the meantime, we hope you enjoyed this session. Attendees at the moment already, so yeah, good signs. Quite excited, but yeah, without further ado, let's make a proper start. And what have you seen in the news? I'm sure everyone's been a bit up to speed with certain happenings this week.
Yeah, Phil, you wanted to start with something, didn't you, I believe?
Well, I read, it really irritated me, actually. I read a re- report last week in the Manchester Evening News from a security expert who was basically saying that a security expert has issued a stern warning to homeowners who have smart doorbells or CCTV at home, stating they could face a potential £100,000 penalty from the Information Commissioner Office. What? You know, why do people put these scare stories? This guy is selling security technologies, but I read that and I thought, oh, no wonder. No wonder people have a downer on, you know, these guys that don't really understand how it works or what the ICO's priorities are or, you know, the household exemption, which may or may not apply. But it's saying in this article, it's illegal to secretly record even in private venues. Oh, yeah. You know, it's just like it's just irritating. But I'm going to put a link in there so you can all get equally irritating as me. I was hoping that there was some sort of comment on the Manchester Evening News that you could add your comments, but there wasn't. There was just this sentiment analysis. So I highlighted angry. This story makes me angry. That could be interpreted as I'm angry with the data protection law being so silly as to, you know, potentially fine with that. But I'm just angry with the blooming story. Yeah. So that wound me up, I have to say, as you might have gathered. I shall calm down now. I don't know if you noticed in the news that the European Court of Justice has kind of been looking at what's meant by conflict of interest. You may remember many weeks or months ago that a data protection officer in Germany was sacked for being also chairman of the Works Council. Do you remember that? You possibly don't, but I remember we talked about it a little bit. I mean, it's gone through German courts, it's gone to the European Court of Justice now, and they've said that there is a possibility of data protection officers having conflicts of interest, but those types of positions don't really count. They're saying if a data protection officer is determining the means and the purposes for processing, then they're likely to have a conflict of interests. That's one of the use cases they're saying. Obviously, if you've kind of auditing your own work, that would be another potential conflict of interest, but kind of competing objectives being the thing, the Work Council chairpersonship not being something that that would probably fall into that kind of a category. So that was quite interesting. Yeah, how about a CCTV in a pub toilet? Oh, right, I'm not seeing that one. Is that Wetherspoons?
I didn't realise that was a case, like a different case at first. I thought you meant as a conflict of interest. But yeah, I've seen something recently about CCTV in schools' toilets as well. It's I feel like there's not really much question around it, to be honest. It's a bit concerning, in my opinion, that, you know, that's even a thing. It's very intrusive, but obviously there's, you know, from one angle there's justifications for it, but I don't think it's balanced at all in when you're considering people's rights.
Is it often balanced, these sort of things? You know, I mean, organizations just do what they want to do, don't they, and then worry about the implications further down the road, and often, you know, as we know, it leads to bigger, more convoluted issues, doesn't it? So
yeah, that can tend to be the issue of not bringing in the data protection team either early on or at all, which is often the case.
Yeah.
So thank you, Joe, for pointing out
that's all right.
Yeah, for anybody new to the session, we usually start off with a roundup of the news, as Joe's quite right, it says in the chat. To be honest, we also talk about what we've been doing this week, because that's usually some quite interesting cases. I've been doing some really quite good, interesting work this week. And then we'll get into the main topic. That's generally what we do. But, you know, we can do however you want, really.
Well, yeah, my week's been bizarre, though, to be honest. We had 2 days this week of staff training as such. You call it staff training?
No, it was a quarterly consultant meeting. So we all got together.
I guess so, yeah.
It's much more about kind of just getting together, really, spending a bit of time, you know, looking at the business rather than doing stuff in the business, you know what I mean? So that was good. Takes a bit of prep for, but it was really nice to get everybody together and spend time together, as I say, in that kind of environment.
Agree. Yeah. Some interesting topics of conversation as well. And, you know, quite a big things coming my way in my role with, you know, the addition of starting to do audits and training. So yeah, it was useful. So, but because of that, and because I've been playing catch up all week, really, I've not really had too much time to prep for this session like I normally do. I like to set myself a few hours aside, but that being said, this year I reckon I've done about 60-70 calls on Ropers this year, so I like to think I'll be able to add some value to the podcast. However, the one story I did see in the news, unless you two want to talk about your week, Jasmine, you've not really been here, have you?
Well,
I mean, it's been, you know, absolute catching up, trying to. It's a lot to come back into. But yeah, I'm just trying to get my head back around things, jump back into the world of data protection after, you know, Glastonbury. So it's been good to get my head around things again. It's been progressive from Wednesday morning. But yeah. One thing that I did want to talk about before we get into the main part of the session is the general election, though. So obviously Labour, you know, are now they've won the election and they're going to be our government for the next few years. And what that, you know, what effect that will have on data protection. Obviously the Data Protection and Digital Information Bill wasn't included in the wash up. It is mostly dead. Will it come back? Who knows? Your thoughts on that?
As far as I'm aware, there was nothing in the Labour manifesto really around data protection. I think they put something in there about AI. I can't really remember what it was. I throw my hands up and say that I didn't really read any manifestos, but I did search kind of, you know, what has any of the manifestos been, you know, mentioned data protection. I'm almost certain none really did other than Labour, but it was more on AI than data protection itself. So hard to say, I think, Jasmine. Although that being said, the ICO left some comments, I think, didn't they? I saw it in a news article last week, and I think they're still anticipating some other sort of similar legislation to the DPDI bill will be coming in, I think, or will try and come in moving forward. So unfortunately, I don't think it's the end of it, but
yeah,
hard to say when that will be or what it will look like.
The thing is, I feel like me personally, and maybe us collectively, spent a lot of time bashing the DPDI bill for various reasons. I said it a couple of weeks ago on our charity episode that, you know, sometimes I'd forget to read the room. So I'd be, you know, celebrating that the DPDI bill's gone and then forgetting that charities wouldn't be happy because the soft opt-in has also gone for charities then as well. It reminded me that there were a couple of positives to come from it. So my hopes are, you know, that there is, if there is any changes to data protection legislation, that those positive elements are taken. But I don't think it needs a complete overhaul at all. But obviously, you know, with the progression and wake of AI, that technology is going in a new direction, and it's just making sure that existing legislation and new legislation covers that. So there will most likely be some changes to come. It's just hopefully this government will get it a bit more right.
I hear your points on kind of, you know, around us not reading the room and seeing the positive side of things. But I think for me, what it always has come down to is that the negatives of the bill completely outweighed the positives of the bill. You know, they did have the odd good thing in there with recognised legitimate interests and, as you said, soft opt-in being made available for charities. But then, like, the narrowing of the definition of personal data was a major concern for me. You know, that could have meant that a lot of data that is currently caught would not be caught, and therefore people wouldn't have rights to that. And to me, that's a lot more, you know, crucial to what the law is about, right? It's about protecting rights, not providing free passes for organizations to do what they want, because otherwise what's the point of having such legislation in place?
No, that's a good point. I don't know if there's any other news Phil, if you've got any thoughts on that.
I got no thoughts to add to that, but I did notice, I don't know if you saw this, a news story by Vincent Mason about the way that Snapchat have approached their data protection impact assessment with the ICO. So you may recall that Snapchat got kind of dragged in by the ICO for non-compliance with Article 35 and 36. But you know, they've engaged with the ICO, and over the course of several months have now got to a point where the ICO is heavily caveated, saying they're quite happy with Snapchat's AI bot in respect of Article 35 and Article 36. So they quite clearly say, but we're not sure about other aspects of it. But what they're basically saying in this article, which is quite interesting to read, is, you know, engage with the ICO early, work with them, take their concerns on board, and you'll get a really good, much better, more positive outcome than you would do if you either ignored them or, you know, brought them in at the very last minute. So I thought that was quite interesting. And this week I've been doing, in fact, today, this morning, I had a call with a new startup that is providing some a platform for doing remote Well, they said it was remote inspections of properties and things. So I was intrigued to find out what that was all about. But again, they've kind of got in early. They're asking opinions about how do we do this and how do we do that, which is good. But one of the people on the call said, God, it sounds like a lot of hard work and red tape. You know, how long is it going to take us to go through all these policies and ropers and and things? And I said, well, it doesn't take that long. It's a process you got to go through. It's just like other aspects of business related, like health and safety law. You know, you have to just go through the process. You know, it'll only take you a couple of days work spread over several weeks or months. So it's not massively onerous, which brings me back to your point on the DPEDI bill. You know, I think that, you know, some of it is quite hard. Another really interesting call I had this week was with a client, which is kind of segueing into this topic, really. Now, he rang me up and said, you know, I've got these ropers I've inherited and I just do not know where to start with them. They are all over the place. What do I do to move it forward? So, you know, it is bureaucratic and it is quite hard work, but, you know, it serves a purpose.
A big purpose at that as well, right? It's, you know, to me, a roper is a crucial component of an organization's data protection infrastructure because it helps organizations understand what's going on. It allows you to fulfill your rights or obligations, should I say, as a data controller in providing transparent privacy notices. And I also think that it helps organizations comply with the principles of data protection because it allows you to see what's actually going on and paint a bit of a picture with each process and activity, and then you can kind of work your way through the principles. So yeah, quite rightly, as you say, Phil, they're very crucial, aren't they? But I think they're often overlooked. And Jasmine, you said pre that I think, was it overlooked, the term you used? You say underappreciated as a tool?
Yeah, underappreciated, maybe undervalued as well. I think a lot of people, or a lot of organizations, you know, they recognize that a roper might be needed, but at the same time, you know, it'll be on the list. They don't realize how useful that document actually is. In, you know, the wider data protection compliance and navigating through other responsibilities, you know, it's not seen as a initial primary task that then leads on to the rest. And I think as well, we were saying before, you know, how many ROPA projects we've got going on at the moment at DPP, helping organizations. Yeah. Like, I feel partly responsible for that because I'll be having conversations with some of my accounts and saying, you know, have you got a roper in place? That's a good starting point. And they're like, I was like, right, okay, we'll help you with that. And then from there, we can look at what else needs to be worked on. And then I come into the support guys with, you know, with my tail between my legs and just say, we've got another one.
No, that's interesting because I was just about to say that, yeah, well, people have probably got now mature ropers and therefore they may be due for a significant external review. But what you're saying there is they haven't got them at all, Jasmine.
I think a lot of the time, you know, they'll have been so... roles change, don't they? And people, you know, people come into positions and not everyone's been in the position since 2018. And a lot of the time, a ROPA will have been implemented when GDPR came in and not touched since. It's seen probably as a tick box exercise at the time without, you know, really understanding the value of it and the importance of maintaining it and the difficulty in, you know, getting it up to scratch after not maintaining it and letting it slip, really. So I think that's probably the most common occurrence. And sometimes it'll be so outdated that it's worth starting again. And, you know, at the time, I think as well, people won't have had as good an understanding of data protection as they do now. So it might have inaccurate information in it. And yeah, there's all of these things that come into play. It's never just a straightforward situation, but, you know, it's quite common.
Yeah, but Lawrence hits a nail on the head, doesn't it? You know, why are we doing them is the big question. You know, because it does become an industry in itself, you know, and it's like a fourth row bridge. You've created these things. And you rightly say, Jasmine, you know, if these were created in 2018, when systems weren't mature, processes weren't mature, understanding wasn't necessarily mature, you know, then you've kind of inherited these because you come into a job and you look at it and think, Christ, I don't know where to start. Yeah, but why are we doing them? And if it's just to tick that Article 30 box, you know, they have to be something that is useful, worth maintaining. And yeah, the where the GDPR maybe gets it wrong is, are they worth maintaining. You know, they're not public facing. It's an internal document. The only reason for keeping them, according to the GDPR, is so that the supervisory authority can call them in and have a look at them, understand what's going on. But even if they did call them in and have a look at them, they're still not going to understand what's going on necessarily, because it might not be complete. You know, might not have everything on it. So they've got no frame of reference. It would have been far better, I think, to have had ROPAs as public-facing documents, something that you have a responsibility for either publishing or putting on the database, you know, the register of fee payers. But of course, GDPR scrapped the whole notion of registration. So, you know, that I think was a big mistake, you know, because it does become literally a box ticking exercise for something that nobody will ever look at, apart from data protection, you know, officers.
So why is it a legal requirement then? Is it the kind of the method of trying to emphasize to organizations that it's important because it's going to help you out, as opposed to, you know, people are going to ask to look at it? Because as you said, people don't often see it, do they, other than the ICO? And if the ICO do look at it, what can they understand from a ROPA that they wouldn't be able to understand from looking at a privacy notice that is public facing?
Yeah, that's a good question. There's a lot of questions in there, and I can't remember all of them that you posed. But I think one of them, what you said was, I can't remember what you said now.
I said, why is it a legal obligation then, if it's kind of
something
that you're often not going to see? Is it kind of the?
I think it's a cornerstone of accountability. It's a cornerstone of accountability, able to demonstrate you know what's going on, you know. But who are you demonstrating that to? Is it an internal document? You know, is it meant to be consumed by data subjects who incidentally have got no right to look at a ROPA? Or is it something to be consumed by the supervisory authority in the event of them having cause to look at them? I think it's unclear, but I think being a cornerstone of accountability. Personally.
Well, I guess what it does do, it paints a picture for each specific process and activity, doesn't it? So if you were to understand that there's a breach that's happened at an organization and the ICO was to reach out, you know, if there wasn't a ROPA, they'd have to ask for a lot of documents, and then the organization would have to go and try and find this stuff, find out where the data is going to, who it's going to, where it's going, you know, the lawful basis applied, whereas a ROPA just nicely paints a picture, doesn't it? It keeps it nice, short and sweet.
Well, it all relates
specifically to the purpose, whereas a privacy policy will say, we send it
These are recipients.
These are recipients, but it doesn't relate specifically back to a specific purpose of processing. So I guess that's where it's really good, isn't it? That it aligns in
There's such a lot in the chat. There's such a lot to talk about ROPAs, isn't there? But I mean, there's in the chat, they're talking about the information asset registers, and we sometimes see kind of IARs half converted into ROPAs, and I say half converted because. And I think that I was very confused about an information asset register, you know, what's its purpose, you know, what should be in it. But to me, information asset registers are information repository orientated, that, you know, buckets of data. But ROPAs are purpose orientated. So, you know, you might use an information asset register, an information asset for several purposes, and a data processing activity per purpose might rely on several information assets. It might take data from some information assets and post them into other information assets. So I think personally, for me, the two things are distinctly different. And we do see people trying to combine them together, which kind of works in a simple scenario. But the more complex things get, I think the more difficult it is to merge them and get them both to work to fulfill their purpose. But I always ask, for anybody who says an information asset register, my first question is, well, what's the purpose of the information asset register? You know, is it for ISO 27001 compliance or PCI compliance? Or, you know, why have you got one? Because there's no legal requirement to have one under the GDPR.
Yeah.
So what's the objective of it? And if it's, again, if it's just to keep track of pots of data, who owns them, what's in them, you know, how are they maintained, where are they located? That's fine. But ROPA contains some of the same data, but purpose orientated.
Yeah, it goes over my head a little bit sometimes, you know, when people want to combine the two, because like you say, they do come from different places, you know, being asset and process focused. And in that sense, you know, how granular are you expected to go from a ROPA standpoint if it's an information asset register? Because, you know, I feel like information asset registers are much more granular than a process, because a process can involve multiple assets. So when I hear that, I just try and, you know, steer people away from it, because it, I feel like it can overcomplicate it, and you end up having this document that's even longer than, you know, and harder to understand than it would be, really.
Yeah, I mean, an asset register again is granularity, I think, is absolutely key for both ROPAs and IARs. And some people have like systems lists, you know, we have Salesforce as our information and asset, for instance. But within Salesforce, we've got discrete pots of data. We've got our employee records, we've got our prospect records, we've got our opportunities and sales records, we've got our job records. You know, we've got a whole load of different things. And they are, to me, they're all individual information assets. Equally, you know, if you extract a report, that in itself, in theory, is its own information asset, or it might be part of a bundle of data, like sales reports, which is the information asset, you know. So I have to say, I do get confused about information asset registered, because, well, yeah, that's it. I do.
Well,
they're not a legal requirement, though, are they? So it's up to you what you put in your information asset register, right? Is there any sort of guidelines out there? I don't know. It's not. They're not things I often come across. But
there are standards. So, you know, the ISO 27001 standard does set out, you know, what it thinks for its purposes should be in an IAR. Sure. But if you've got, you know, an information asset register for PCIDSS purposes, it's different information for script management, for instance, you know. So it's kind of horses for courses, but ROPAs are specifically defined what should be in them, not the granularity, but the kind of the columns of data.
Yeah, I agree. There's a lot to talk about, though, isn't there? And it's kind of quite hard to pinpoint where to kind of begin.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to say a question, but it's just very out there. But it's something that's kind of crossed my mind. Not out there, I guess. But Phil, what's your opinion on, if say you get a ROPA, you're a new DPO, you inherit a ROPA, you have a look at it, and it's the lawful bases are way off. The organization doesn't quite understand that you can process personal data without consent of the data subject, and therefore they rely on consent for 80% of the processes. And you know that if, you know, say, for example, they it's got like IT help desk and they rely on consent, and you know that if the person withdraws the consent, they're not going to be able to get assistance with you know, any tickets they might have with issues and equipment. How do you go about changing that lawful basis? Because we know that it's very difficult to change lawful basis, isn't it? And especially when consent's involved. So
question. Is it what? Sorry.
I was going to say, is it a case of just being a little bit pragmatic and saying that although we've got it wrong, there's nothing we can do, we have to change it because it's going to impact organization and the way that it works?
Well, in reality, that's what you have to do. I mean, again, I think the ICO is dead wrong when they say, you know, if you've got consent down, then, and somebody withdraws their consent, then that's it, it's game over. I get that, but if consent's wrong in the first place, you have to change it, surely. You can't just keep muddling on thinking it's consent, you know, and oh, it is consent because we've got the employees to sign these forms when they start with us, you know, which they probably don't read. I think you have to look at it and think, well, is that the most appropriate lawful basis in these circumstances? And if it's not, then you change it. But changing the lawful basis, I think, is a significant variation to processing. And therefore, you'd probably have to refresh your privacy notices. So it's not a simple task. Because if you've got like a million customers and you're changing some aspects of your privacy information, it's a lot of work to try to go to, you know, best endeavors, not reasonable endeavors. I think best endeavors to ensure that there's more chance than not of the customer's data subjects having access to the revised privacy information. And we've been through this with a lot of our customers. Again, quite a few years ago, I did some work with some online businesses, and, you know, for them to push out new privacy information, you know, it's not impossible, but they have to take a multi-channel approach. You put something in the portal, put something on the statements, put something on the website, you know, do all these different things, put something on your IVR voice announcement, do all these different things, because what we've got to do is demonstrate we've done what we can. And the ICO, I think, would take that into account. If you've done over and above, but still not caught everybody, you know, with an update, they'll probably rule, you know, say, well, you've done what you can in these circumstances.
Yeah. And I guess, could you take that approach then that you're a DPO, you've come in, you've done what you can, you've noticed that the previous DPO has got it way wrong and you've had to make some changes. Unfortunately, it's against you know, guidelines and best practice from the ICO. But like you say, you're stuck, aren't you? You can't, if a process, if well, a global basis is wrong and it's going to impact the way an organization works, then you're not left with, you ain't got a choice.
You've got to change it. You know, I think you've got to change it. So one of the ones we see quite often wrong is, you know, contract. Oh, we've got a contract with a supplier and that's what why we're purchasing personal data. No, that's the wrong application of contract. You know, the contract has to be with the data subject. It has to be a party to the contract for it to work. So if you've got contract and it's wrong, or legal obligation, but there isn't one, again, we see that quite often, you've got to change it. Because otherwise, you know, your processing is not based. What, no matter what the ROPA says, the processing isn't based on a lawful basis that's grounded.
Yeah, because if it's inappropriate, then it's not considered lawful processing, is it?
No, it'd be unlawful processing, really. But I mean, it wouldn't be unlawful processing because you would have another lawful basis, but we're meant to document these and specify them, and, you know, and that's what the ROPA is, just a reflection, as a privacy note, it's a reflection of what is happening in reality. But
yeah,
if you've got a detachment between reality and what the documentation says, I think you have to change it.
Yeah, and just to put it out there, if there is anyone listening that's kind of in the process of doing this, then I think it's wise to document what it was before, what it is now, and why you decided to do that, right? It's all about being accountable.
Yeah, exactly.
Just putting it out there, if there is anyone here that's sat in that conundrum or the experience it moving forward, I think it's a good idea to evidence.
There's tons of talk. There's loads in the chat. I want to pick up one, like helping ROPAs respond to rights requests and breaches. But just get in your DeLorean for a minute, and I want to take you back in time to the year 2007, I think.
Privacy impact assessments. Is that what
No. But you're right. It's about the right time frame. I just want to make sure I share screen. Share the right screen. I've got, it's part, look, I've got no idea what's on these screens current. Oh, it's here, I've got the right one. That's lucky. The other one's a podcast notes. So if those of you been around long enough and have got as many grey hairs as me, will hopefully remember this, the notification handbook. So back in the old days when we had to do a notification, this is 2007, the ICO wrote this to help people get their registrations right. And what we had to do in these days is you had to fill in a form for every processing activity that you were undertaking as a data controller. This is the form. This is quite a good booklet, actually. It is available online, but if you haven't got a copy of it, then happy to send something. So you'd fill in your data controller name, your registration number, you had a security number to make sure that changes to the paperwork were valid, purpose title, brief description of the purpose, and then you had to put in these codes for the data subject, classes of data subjects, the classes of data, you were the classes of recipient, transfers. You know, then you had to fill in one of these for every single processing activity. And then if you change something, you'd have to fill in one of these forms to have an one of these purposes amended or changed. But in this booklet, then there's these kind of standardized things that the ICO had defined as types of, like here, recipients, for instance. And I use this as a bit of a guide for how granular to try and make my ROPAs, because I know it's old stuff and things have moved on significantly, but this is quite useful, I think, to gauge how granular is the ICO probably expecting ROPAs to be. And I might be wrong, you know, I'm not saying that I'm right, but I use this quite, well, I don't anymore, but I used to use it quite a lot. But I don't use it anymore because it's embedded in my head. So when I'm looking at a ROPA, I'm looking for kind of this level of detail as a minimum. And any more detailed, yeah, it might become too hard to understand what's going on.
That's really useful. Thanks for sharing that, Phil. I've actually got a comment on kind of like the granularity that you go on ROPAs. I actually had a call this morning with one of our customers to help with the ROPA, and I met with the IT department of the customer, and we was going through and they were looking at the systems that they use, and the line of organization for backup of all their systems. So obviously, you know, data is in turn processed with that, well, it's sent to the organization in a scenario of a backup, but all the systems that contains all the data in the organization is therefore caught as part of that processing activity when the information is backed up. How would you demonstrate that in a ROPA when it asks for the categories of the personal data that's involved in the processing? I actually asked it to Jasmine, and Jasmine just said maybe you just have to put all information provided within this ROPA. Would that be appropriate?
Sorry, Joe, just scoot over that again. Sorry about that. I was typing.
say, for example, you had a purpose of processing that you put in Europa and it was backup for an IT system. And it backs up all your systems across an organization.
Well, you can't possibly categorize everything you think might be in there. So you got, again, you got to be pragmatic, I think, and generalize. You know, it's effectively it's information that people put into these systems, isn't it? Now, in that case, I would be saying, you know, either you tick all the boxes or you kind of tick other and you write in a narrative, depending on what you're doing with your Europa. If you've got a spreadsheet, you can write what you want. And if you've got a system, you probably would pick other and explain. But when you read the Europa, right? I mean, the Europa, if you read the Europa and you understand what's going on, then it works. If you read the Europa and you don't understand what's going on, it don't work. So in that case, you know, if you've got some narrative in there that explains, you know, that this is really out of your control, whatever people email in or email out is going to be the types of classes of personal data. I think everyone will get that who reads it.
Yeah. Okay. I'll remember that, because I said I'm not sure actually. I was a bit stumped. I was like, I'll ask for a second opinion and I'll come back to you. So yeah, thanks for that. That's really useful. Cara's actually just put in the chat that the University of Liverpool have published their Europa on their website.
Yeah, which I'm just looking at it now.
Which is brilliant. Wouldn't you?
I know.
Why wouldn't you?
I was thinking, you know, there's a requirement to include your technical and organisational measures. Is it a risk in...
Well, there's not a requirement to include them. There's a requirement...
Oh, is it just...
If
applicable.
If applicable, yeah. Now, you might say for the public record, it's not applicable because it might act to highlight vulnerabilities. But again, because there's no legal obligation to publish them, you could publish part of them. I think it's great to put them out there. People can have a look.
But then again, could you argue...
Pick holes in them.
Well, could you argue, though, if you're just going to do certain sections, then it's just covering your privacy notice and that's all that people need to see to understand what's going on. But then I guess you could argue that, as we said earlier, that a privacy policy, although it will include the information, it won't relate specifically to the purpose, will it? It will just list categories of recipients and territories that data goes to, but not align it with a specific purpose.
Yeah. I mean, one of the, I think, interesting things about privacy notices and ROPAs is that they require different information and they use different terminology. So privacy notices use recipients, but ROPAs use disclosures. And, you know, is there a difference? You know, maybe there is, maybe there isn't, I don't know. But I just wonder kind of why they use different terminologies. Posting notices, you know, privacy notices, you don't need to put your technical organizational measures on. But you have to put lawful basis for processing and explain legitimate interests. But the alternative for ROPAs, you don't need to put your lawful basis on, but people do, because it's a good place to put them. But you do have to put your TOMs on if they're, you know, if appropriate. But if you know, again, it's a summary, Jasmine. It's not like, you know, we've got, you know, it doesn't have to be, you know, we've got these exact controls. Oh, by the way, this is how to get around them, you know, in your TOMs. You most of the time they're either not there or they're really super high level. And the other thing, that going back to granularity, if you've got multiple systems being used for a particular data processing purpose, then you've probably got different technical and organizational measures applied to each different system. So again, how on earth are you meant to try and catalog that in an Excel flat based IAR or data or Europa? So if you're using SharePoint and, you know, something else, and you're saying we've got multi-factor authentication, what, on both systems or just on one system? So it's really quite hard, I think, to get the balance right on Europa. I think it's a great idea, but I think it in practice is quite poorly executed through the GDPR.
I wasn't listening to what you were just talking. Sorry, I was looking at the University of Liverpool's. I was looking at University of Liverpool's Europa, and the first thing that came to mind is that it's not very big. And does that then, you know,
no, there's
it puts itself out there, does it not, or is it?
Have you downloaded it?
Yeah, I've downloaded it. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Might still load in.
There's 32 entries to the whole Europa, the whole university. That cannot be right, surely.
This could just be the public one then, maybe.
Oh, I guess so. Yeah, it's up to them how much they share. I mean, it's
that might be relating just to students, I suppose. Not, you know, maybe not all research, you know, but
categories of individuals. There's things on there about employees, students, staff. So I don't know. Like, do you run the risk of putting yourself out there and kind of putting your own foot in the mud kind of thing. Because I know that you could probably argue, well, it's your privacy notice will say otherwise, but you have to trust in a privacy notice that everything in there is covered of what an organization's doing. Whereas if it's not in the ROPA and you know that an organization will do it, then yeah, I just don't know. I just think you're like, I just feel like they're putting themselves out there to be targeted, I guess.
It is quite
short, isn't
quite
it?
Quite big. Yeah, yeah. Like even looking at HR is quite
They've got standard four.
Amongst all organisations. I can't see here recruitment, for example.
I like bulkified, you know, ROPAs, as long as they're not too bulkified that you can't make sense of them. But I've just Googled this ICO registration handbook 2007, and the only place you can find it is actually on our website. So I've just put a link onto it as a PDF downloadable. So I put the link in the chat.
I assume most people have probably opened this ROPA up, and if you have, then you'll probably realise that it's also very vague, isn't it? Like staff administration is not a purpose of processing, isn't it? That's not, you know,
well,
you need
it
to
is,
say,
but there's more, yeah, but it's not, more in there.
Yeah. So I think that's also a tricky point of a ROPA, right? You can either go way too granular and have thousands of entries, or you go superficial and not detailed enough, and it's trying to strike the balance between the two, and it's not an easy thing to do.
I think you've got to consider, you know, when is, say for example with lawful basis, when does the lawful basis change within an activity? How far do you break it down then? Retention, how long do you keep something for? I always use the example of recruitment with successful applicants and unsuccessful applicants.
Yeah, it's a good example.
Yeah, with successful applicants, you'd keep, their application form and any relevant information for as long as they're an employee plus 6 years. And for unsuccessful applicants, you're not going to do that. You'd only keep it for maybe 6 months afterwards. So then you'd have two separate entries, you know, because they differ.
Or you explain it in the retention, you know, rules. So you could, I think you could still conceivably have it as one, but you'd say, you know, 6 months for these and six years for those.
As long as it doesn't get too complicated, I'd say. Yeah. But yeah, I think it's probably more manageable and maintainable to keep it shorter rather than overly granular. But you do still want to make sure that you are accurately recording what you're doing with information, and especially where it differs, making sure that they are recorded as well. So that's how that's the viewpoint that I take it from. I don't try and keep it as short as this Uni of Liverpool one, but it just helps really
there's some brilliant stuff in the chat. We're not going to have time to get through it all, unfortunately. But you know, one of the things that has been said is that, you know, when we said why have we got these ROPAs, you know, some of the comments were, you know, to help us with information rights requests, managing breaches, you know, identifying high risk processing for DPAs. I think the high risk processing DPAs is easy to see. So if you've got descriptions of the types of data, data subjects, lawful basis for processing, special category data, etc., on your ROPAs, and if they're in Excel or any system, you can filter out the stuff that might be high risk, and then you can highlight it and say, right, I'm going to check if you've got a DPA or do a DPA. But I just wondered what people's experiences were of how useful ROPAs were at finding data for rights requests, because you'd have to have it quite granular to help you do that. I just wonder what everyone's view is on
that. That's a really good point, because I mean, me and you, Joe, we talk about it probably too much on this podcast. A certain example with a HR system where somebody complained about having the employee start date on it. The organization's justification was that, you know, it's useful for other staff to see how experienced you are and come to you if they need help, etc., which might be a good justification, might be far-fetched, depends how you look at it, but they couldn't change this piece of software without having to pay for a bespoke option which would cost 30 grand. So they couldn't fulfill this individual's right of erasure, you know, to remove that information just off this platform. They still need, obviously the employer still had that information elsewhere, but just, you know, for it to be publicly available to the rest of the organization. And it's something that you just think is the smallest issue, and you know, you might not consider that when you're considering someone's right to erasure, you know, to that level, like you say, Phil, how granular it is. But I think that's, you know, the nature of data protection really is that anything, you know, people, you can't predict everything, every single issue that somebody might have, every response or reaction that someone might have to how you use people's information. And it can be a really hard balance to find.
Yeah, I'm just going to read some of this on the chat about. It says, I don't think, for instance, the stairs will require the publishing of IARs or ROPAs, because I think this, for those not in housing, this is the social tenant access to information requirements, which is a bit like Freedom of Information Act and requiring social housing providers to publish certain information to their tenants. It's still, I think, not fully formed. But I, you know, it specifies all these different categories of information that have to be published, like policies and maintenance records and things. But I don't think that these data protection records would fall under that, any of those categories. But again, I'm not wholly convinced that might change or might get interpreted to. I mean, there's still a lot of unknowns about that, including exemptions and, you know, does it only apply to tenants, or has the general public got a right to information under the stairs scheme? But my understanding of it is that I don't think that ROPAs would be one of those documents that has to be published under the stairs.
Sean said data protection is on the list, but it hasn't been clarified exactly what. So I don't know how much has been clarified at this point, to be honest. Well, maybe since I've been away, but it's been going on for a while now.
Yeah, I mean, governance and decision making is on, you know, spending, housing stock management, performance, housing services, list and register. So data protection might come into those types of things. Sean probably knows more about it than I do, to be honest. But, you know, performance might be also including performance relating, responding to subject tax requests or breaches or whatever. As I say, Sean is probably in the industry. He's in the industry and knows more about it than me, probably. But it could be or it could be not. I wouldn't have thought that kind of information, ROPAs, would be required to be published under stairs, but I might be wrong.
I can't say I've had a look at it, so I can't comment, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think that Christina's comment that the ROPA feeds a provision is fab, because, you know, when we're doing an audit of ROPAs and an audit of privacy notice, we try and triangulate all the three different things: that actually what's going on in practice, where can I find this processing activity in the ROPA, and where can I find it in the privacy notice. And equally, you know, if I'm looking at a ROPA, I find a row and I say, well, go and take me to that piece of the business, let me go and have a look at it, you know, and where is it in the privacy notice. So the three things absolutely should be in you know, close correlation with each other.
In terms of auditing ROPAs, I don't know, I suppose there's two ways to look at it, you know, one from an internal perspective and then one from an external perspective. But I think it's probably difficult to, you know, to be able to pick holes as much from an external perspective in organisations, process and operations, if you know where I'm coming from. I don't know, Phil, you've got experience in auditing.
Say that again.
In terms of being able to pick holes in a ROPA and you know, be able to determine its effectiveness, how do you go about that from an external standpoint?
Well, we've written an internal how-to audit ROPAs guide for, you know, make sure we're all on the same page with it internally. And, you know, it really is, I start off by looking at the ROPA and checking that structurally it's got, if it's an Excel sheet, has it got all the right columns of information in it? That's my first starting point. I look at how many rows are on it, and I'm thinking, is it likely to cover all processing activities? I think of common business departments like marketing, HR, finance, IT. See if there's anything on for those. Look at the operational stuff that goes on. Well, where's that on the ROPA? And then, you know, I'm looking at it. You know, are there gaps in it? Are there things that don't make sense? You know, are there made up lawful bases for processing? If it's spread on multiple sheets, have people modified the structure of it to suit their own purposes? Have we got special category data listed but not a lawful basis? Are the lawful bases looking about right? So there's quite a lot, you know, of stuff. Are there named recipients, and do I know that some of them operate internationally and likely to be international transfers? So you honestly can look at a ROPA for 5 or 10 minutes and think, yeah, this is probably all right, or no, this is definitely not right. And then once we've got a feel for, you know, is it likely or unlikely, you know, how good is it likely to be? It's then a question of, you know, well, let's try and test whether it is working, you know, with the privacy information, and is it working with the actual business operations? So it does take quite a while to do a decent review of it. And if it's spread over multiple sheets, the first thing I do is I grab it all and I stick it all on one spreadsheet, because then I can start to filter it and, you know, rank it by order. Another common, I think, error is that often they don't have unique reference numbers on them for each row, so they're relying on the numbering on Excel, row one, row two, row three. But if I sort them in different order, all the row numbers change. But you need to have a way of specifically identifying this particular row per entry, which is better if it's a unique, like row per 001, row per 002. And Excel will do all that sequential numbering for you automatically. But if it's not there, and you, in our audit reports, we're saying, you know, this one looks wrong, it then gets quite verbose, because you're having to use the actual processing description to pinpoint it on the Roper. But I mean, it's a good exercise to do, to really scrutinize the Ropers. But you have to do it on multiple levels, I think.
Yeah, no, that's a good approach to it, to be fair. I think, you know, there are some elements that are quite simple in understanding whether it's compliant or not, whether it's accurate or not. But then, I don't know, I think coming into the nitty-gritty of things at times, depending on the type of organisation and how familiar you are with it, it can be it can pose different challenges. Yeah. But
and then kind of the final angle is about management. So looking at structure, looking at content, looking at Roper management. Where's the policy on Roper management? Where's the audit trail of changes? You know, how can you demonstrate this is under proper governance? And again, I often find that there's gaps in that as well. Sorry, Joe, I interrupted there.
Go on, Joe. You got something?
No. I was going to add on to what Phil was saying, but I wasn't sure if you wanted to just finish off your point,
okay.
Jasmine. I something I really want to talk about is the, you know, we've spoke a lot about the build of a Roper, but not so much about what comes after that. But I'm conscious we've only got 9 minutes left, and should we start talking about it, and we can maybe pick it up on a part two?
Yeah, carry on.
Or do you want to try and whiz through it in 9 minutes?
Carry on, try and whiz through it.
Before you do, Jill's just got a question. So what do most organizations end up forgetting to put on their ROPA? Is it a particular element, such as internal systems or types of process and elements?
Good question.
Yeah. I mean, from my experience of doing it on behalf of organizations, would probably be the types of process and elements of, you know, what's actually happening at an organization. But that's because when we help a customer build their ROPA, it's quite difficult for us to fully understand, unless we've been working with them as a DPO, as to what's actually going on. So we have to rely a little bit on the organization, don't we, to, you know, provide us with what they do and understand what they do. And I think that's quite tricky, isn't it? Especially when you're talking with people who don't fully understand the law, trying to explain to somebody what processing is, it's not a particularly easy task. And talking through lawful grounds of processing as well, it's quite tricky. And I think that's what you'll often find, is especially if you have process owners, or if you're speaking to each department and the department isn't particularly clued up on data protection, you know, jargon, it's finding that balance of trying to be able to demonstrate what you want from them, but not get too, you know, deep down and stuck in words such as process activities and lawful basis and international transfers and so on. So I think that's what I've probably experienced, is things often get missed because people probably don't understand that it's processing of personal data.
I don't think that things get forgotten to be put on ROPAs. I'm not sure we forget. But what I find is often a lot of the entries are just superficial. You cannot get to the grip of it. People writing kind of yes or no answers where you actually want some narrative is a common problem.
And I think
other issues, you know, internationalization, recipients, you know, retention indefinite or in perpetuity, which, you know, they say they should state what is reality. But, you know, when people write indefinite, I think often they're put together by operational people who don't know the answer to the questions, and they just want to get the exercise completed and off their desks.
Yeah, I think that's what I see the most of is not so much, you know, accidental misses. It's more just the lack of understanding and knowledge. It's especially around, you know, the more legal jargon, like lawful basis and the lack of understanding around that. International transfers, that there tends to be a lack of understanding around what that actually means as well. You know, I don't know, just things like that, really, retention especially. It does depend on where you are as an organisation already, you know, how sophisticated your data protection framework is, and then in terms of how easy it is to either create or improve on Europa.
I was going to say to Simon, I honestly can't remember how you claim the credits. So I was hoping Miles does. So before we finish this, Miles can come on and explain how to do the IAP CP credits. I'm looking through for the certificate. I don't think it says on the certificate. Sorry, Joe, carry on. I interrupted
you. No, sorry. I was just going to add on to Jasmine.
He'll send an email
off. Yeah, he will. Yeah. I was just going to add on to Jasmine's point around kind of around like things that are not often necessarily forgotten, but probably inaccuracies. But I think what Europa is quite good at doing, especially if you're doing one on an organization that hasn't got Europa and it's from scratch, is that it's quite a good tool for identifying areas of non-compliances around, you know, for example, retention periods. And I don't, it's not a, it's not something that's required on Europa, but something that I don't think anyway, but something that I've started collecting information around is whether data subjects are issued privacy information about the specific purpose of processing. And quite often, more often than not, you find out that it's not. And obviously, it's a requirement of Article 13 to inform data subjects of, you know, the process and that it's happening. And I think it's, I just think the completion of Europa is a very good tool to identify where you may be, you know, missing certain aspects of your data protection compliance or your obligations.
Yeah. And aside...
So I'm going to say just quickly, I'm going to show this on screen. You carry on talking. Danielle's asked about software. There are lots of different bits of software and people are probably most familiar with OneTrust. You carry on talking because I'm just going to, I'll share my screen and show kind of a system, our system. But I mean, we're not trying to plug this. We're just trying to show you that there are systems out there. OneTrust is probably the most well known for managing this. They call this data mapping. But you carry on talking, Jasmine, while I just click through example here.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, aside from, you know, all of these points we've raised about the importance of ROPAs, one of the biggest ones for me is involving everyone within the organization who handles personal data and, you know, improving and increasing their awareness and understanding of data protection, their own responsibilities within it, and just improving the overall culture, because that can often be the hardest thing in an organization, is getting everyone on board. And you know, like I deal with so many organizations, and it can be luck of the draw, you know, if you get a new DPO in an organization and the culture's there or it's not. And I really feel for those that it isn't there already, because it can be really tricky, especially when it comes from the top as well, and there's frustration that comes with it. And if you're in that situation and you don't have a strong ROPA in place, use this as an example, or, you know, to improve it. And it does get people asking questions and trying to get their head around it, especially by assigning responsibility to each department and saying, look, this is your responsibility to have to maintain your department's part of the ROPA. You know, and then they come to you with questions, and from there you can stem onto other parts of data protection law, and within that you can inform them, and you know, the importance around breaches and rights, and it just gets the conversation started, really.
Yeah,
I without think we'll the fear mongering, which is sometimes necessary.
But it's not easy to do, is it, to embed culture? And I think we'll definitely be having a part two, won't we, where we'll probably look at the next phase of the ROPA, where we'll actually try and give some examples of, you know, how to do that and maintaining your ROPA and what you actually require to do. Just before pass over to you, Phil, Miles has put in the chat a link of where you can log your attendance here and gain credits for each episode you listen to. And Phil, you've got about 2 minutes before people start dropping off and going for the lunch.
Everyone's probably already dropped off, but in a different sense. No, we're just trying to show this is like an Excel sheet of, you know, how you might have, you know, everything set up for a ROPA. And if you've got like 100 rows or even 30 rows, you know, it's quite a big thing to look at. And that's what most people do, because it's easy, it's accessible, it's easy to maintain. This is kind of a systematic approach with the system, you know, where you've got a database of these things. But the reality is that there's a relationship between, you know, for instance, the ROPA and the information asset registers, the entries, as we've talked about before. And in this case, this particular, this is test data, but this ROPA is, you know, interacts with four different information assets, three different processors. This particular processor has got three different international transfers. But getting that kind of level of detail, you know, linked to a DPA, etc., getting that level of detail in a spreadsheet can be quite difficult. And you'll see here, for instance, I've spelt visitors wrong because it's a text entry. So if you start searching for stuff in a because it's not normalized data, validated data, then potentially, you know, it kind of, you need it all standardized, don't you? Otherwise it
would be missed.
Yeah. But I do this if I'm doing, so if I'm doing international transfers, I would put Czech Republic, brackets, Avast, Singapore, Ireland, and the US managed engine. So you can get data, you know, lots of information into one row rather than, because as soon as you start stripping it out for everything, it just becomes really unmanageable. And that's why I would, with your recruitment thing, retention policy, I'd be kind of articulating it within the row, Jasmine, if I could and if it made sense. Mm. Something that people often forget, I think, is that the Data Protection Act, if you're using substantial public interest conditions, the Data Protection Act requires you to have these additional fields on. Is data retained in line with the retention policy? And have you got an appropriate policy document? And that's why the ICO's template has got those on them to accommodate the DPA. But it's the DPA, not the GDPR, that requires those to go on additionally to the ROPA, as everyone probably knows. Anyway, that was just talking about systems. There's quite a few out there.
Yeah, thanks for that, Phil. And thanks, Joe, for the shout out for DataWise in the chat. that is the hour mark, to be fair. So we'll probably call it there and we'll do a part two on this where we'll discuss probably, you know, OK, we've discussed a lot about ROPAs and how, you know, the issues around them and how you maintain them. But then what else is there beyond that? Is, you know, risks, what risks arise from ROPAs and how do you manage those? And Joe, you've done a lot of work on that recently, haven't you? So I'd like to go into that. I don't know if anyone else listening would, but if you
we've not talked about process of ROPAs, we've not talked about exemptions from came to maintain ROPAs, you know, how the ICO's right to inspect actually works in practice. I think there's quite a lot still to chew the fat on this.
When are we going to do that, though? Because, I mean, we could do it in 2 weeks, but I'm not here, Phil, and you're not here. So I don't know if Jasmine wants to do it with Kane.
Done a lot of ROPAs, yeah.
Yeah, or we could park it for when we're all back together and we could do one then.
But it's summer, so it might be a little while.
It's true, but there'll be a part two coming eventually, I'm sure.
We'll keep you updated anyway. Keep an eye out for it. But yeah, thank you everyone for joining. We'll be back next week with a GDPR radio. Well, I won't be back. I'll be off again in Berlin, but
no, it's just, just me.
I'm away as well.
It's going to be an hour of me chatting to myself, guys. I am able to do that. So make sure you chime in.
There's Kane in the chat as we speak. I think that's him volunteering for next week.
Yeah, I'm gonna ask Katerina as well if she wants to join me as well. Actually, I'm not gonna ask her. She's doing the podcast with me next week, so look out for that one.
Excellent. Thanks very much, everyone.
You go.
Have a great weekend.
Cheers. See you later.
Thanks for joining us. Bye.
Bye.